shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Darling, here in my heart, yeah, I do believe we shall overcome someday.
That's from Bruce Springsteen's We Shall Overcome. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Springsteen biographer Dave Marsh pioneered the use of serious writing about popular music to address social and political issues, whether he was writing about Elvis, Pete Seeger, or MC5. Marsh's acerbic writing influenced generations of musicians, writers, and activists, including my guest today, UW-Madison Professor Emeritus Craig Werner, author of A Change is Gonna Come, Music, Race, and the Soul of America. The recent publication of Dave Marsh's Kick Out the Jams, Jams, Jibes, Barbs, Tributes, and Rallying Cries from 35 Years of Music Writing provides an unparalleled look at the continued impact of the music of the 1960s. Part of the editorial team that assembled Kick Out the Jams, Craig Werner reported that when they asked Dave Marsh about the collection, he responded, "Fine, as long as I have nothing to do with it." So joining me to talk about Kick Out the Jams, Dave Marsh, the 60s, and the Sound of Freedom, is Craig Werner. Welcome back to University of the Year.
Happy to be here.
So tell us first about Dave Marsh. He seems, from what I've read and experienced in this Kick Out the Jams collection, like a very interesting, colorful figure.
To say the least. Dave Marsh is a friend and a mentor, and I'm one of a large number of people who would say that about him. You would also find people who would say he is irascible, difficult, opinionated, and fill in your adjective of choice there. All true. Dave Marsh is fiercely committed to understanding the connections between music and the world we're living in all kinds of different ways. He's fiercely committed to networking people, making connections of people who would otherwise be outside of the worlds of celebrity in which he walks. He was the record review editor of Rolling Stone, a founding editor of Cream. Many people consider those the most important music magazines to emerge from the 1960s. But above all, Dave is a fantastic writer whose clarity and depth of insight resonates through all of the essays in this collection. I came to him via his book, The Heart of Rock and Soul, which is a countdown of the 1001 greatest singles of the rock and soul era, which in a very literal way taught me how to listen, how to write about, how to think about music. It's 1001 short essays, but if you immerse in it, you'll come out understanding not just the music, but the times the music was made in, the post-war era, better than any other book I know of. What we did when we put together Kick Out the Jams is we wanted a follow-up to Dave's earlier anthology of writings, Fortunate Son, to assert his importance in the world of music writing. Music writing in recent times has tended towards hot takes on digital platforms, towards celebrity glitz and gossip, and in academia towards a kind of theoretical abstraction. Dave has little patience for any of those. He wants us to listen, and he wants the way we listen to affect the way we live.
Before we talk about his take on some particular musicians like Pete Seeger and others, can we talk about this, the power of the critic and the sort of, I guess you almost could call it arrogance, someone who thinks they should be the arbiter of taste, that they can tell you which band is good and which is not. It reminds me of within, you know, my field of literature, someone like Harold Bloom, who will decide what the canon is. And he's an, you know, extremely well-read Shakespeare scholar, but he will tell you which Jane Austen novel or which poem is good and which is not. And in the case of Dave Marsh, he will tell you which band is terrible. He'll praise others. And I'm assuming that that is partly why he has this reputation for being acerbic, for doing jibes and barbs Can you talk about the power of the critic?
Sure. He's not slow to tell you how he feels about something, to say the very least. He can't stand Bono of U2. He loves Pete Townsend and The Who. And you could go down and do an entire history. Loves Patti Smith, and on and on. But what's unique about Dave is while he is not ever hesitant to tell you what he's thinking, he's doing that so that you can figure out what you think. He wants you to know why you are feeling like you do, how you're responding. He wants informed responses. Dave's not academic. He had only minor connection with the educational system beyond high school, but he's one of the world's great teachers because he provokes you to defend, to challenge, to talk about things. I worked with him on the nominating committee of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for 20 years or so, and that is an argument about the canon. It's who counts, who goes down in the history. And Dave would always be assertive about who he was backing, but he would listen carefully to the other arguments. And you didn't always convince him, but at times you did, and you always knew that he was going to listen respectfully to what you had to say. So I think it's a good democratic approach to canon formation. It's all of the voices belong in it, and he has been a champion of the voices, particularly the voices of women, the voices of African Americans. He and I share a love for Chicano music, and he always wanted to make sure that when we say that we want an inclusive canon, we back it up, and we mean it.
We opened with a little bit of Bruce Springsteen's We Shall Overcome, and you mentioned that Dave Marsh was the biographer of Springsteen. There's also a Pete Seeger link to that song as well. Can you talk about Pete Seeger and Dave Marsh?
Yeah, and when we talk about the music of the 1960s, which is one of the things we'll talk about over this hour, you're really talking about music at the moment when it was most intimately tied to freedom movements. And from the world of folk music, the world of traditional American music, almost no one was more important than Pete Seeger on that. Pete Seeger turned the old labor song, I Shall Not Be Moved, into the civil rights anthem, We Shall Overcome. He wrote dozens of songs. He was committed to integrating, desegregating American popular music. And Pete Seeger was a freedom fighter in a very real way. Dave, in Kick Out the Jams, talks about the impact of his hearing Pete Seeger's live concert album, We Shall Overcome, when Dave was 14 growing up in Detroit. Let me read what he has to say about that. I heard We Shall Overcome when I was the son of budding George Wallace supporters, living in an up-south town full of Ku Klux Klansmen and packs of freelance racists, and going to quietly but adamantly all-white schools. The headlines had been filled every day for the past year with freedom riders, preteens slaughtered by bombs placed in churches, nonviolent demonstrators attacked by dogs and high-pressure hoses. And that was just in the South. The one true thing I was being told about this was that it meant the world, or a world, was coming to an end. The one set of contrary facts I held in my head was almost entirely musical, not the early songs of Bob Dylan, but Motown and early soul music that insisted, obliquely but powerfully, that freedom meant everybody, or it didn't mean anything. And when Dave talks about the politics of Motown, that has a huge influence on my thinking and on thinking many other music writers. He frequently would talk about an experience he had growing up in a white working class Detroit neighborhood with a father who, as Dave says here, mm-hmm. was adamantly racist. But he says that the key moment for him was hearing Smokey Robinson in the Miracles song, You Really Got a Hold on Me, which is not usually thought of as a political song. But Dave said that when he heard that song, he knew that everything he was being told about the subhumanity of black people could not be true, that somebody who made that statement could not be inferior. And that, in a very literal way, changed his life.
So the music is really what was the source of his revelation, his change, hearing something in the music. And why in particular Pete Seeger? What did Dave Marsh admire most?
He admired the fact that Pete Seeger both wrote these fantastic songs and followed through on them with action in the world. That what you say is interesting to Dave only in as much as you back it up with what you do. And he learned that from Pete Seeger. I had a dinner. I was blessed with a dinner with Dave and Pete Seeger and the fantastic singer-songwriter Patty Griffin at a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame event celebrating Woody Guthrie. And
that's a lot of names to drop there. That sounds like quite the lunch.
Yeah, no, it really
dinner.
Is. It really is.
Quite a dinner.
I was flabbergasted.
That sounds
by
like
being
something
there.
You dream of or whatever.
Yeah, and my job is to be quiet and listen. But it was clear that Pete Seeger had understood his music as involved with large social patterns. He talked about a friend who had seen. During 1950s, had gone to Harlem and he'd seen the TV antennas on the roofs of the apartment buildings there. And he said, that's changing the world. That's going to change the way that we interact with each other. And Pete Seeger understood that. And he understood that the music was a tool. Dave says often that music doesn't create a movement, but music can power a movement. If the movement is already there, then the music can play a major role in moving it forward. And there's another quote from Dave. He says he credits Seeger with, quote, showing me the road that had to be traveled. If I really wanted to live, he did this the same way that James Baldwin and Elvis Presley and John Coltrane did it, by example, and with the same generosity and the same sense that the world was packed with a load of insurmountable cruelty, and that, nevertheless, the truth was that something better had managed to survive within it, which meant, for each of us, a choice and a chance. And Pete Seeger embodied that choice and that chance.
And a kind of optimism, too, it seems, that the world can get better and that the music is pointing the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Dave and I have talked about the word optimism many times. Mm-hmm. And neither one of us would use that term, but I understand what you mean. What we would say is hope. Cornel West talks about an audacious hope that the world can change, and we have to commit to that, and we have to believe that that's going to happen. And that Pete Seeger had a good humor about him. He was somebody who, if he said he was going to do something, he followed it up. He was getting old at the time they knew him, and when he said that he was going to answer a question, he took out a little notebook and wrote it down. He said, I have to. I might forget otherwise. Mm-hmm. He was on the front lines, and he never bit his tongue. He was famously exiled from the popular music world because of his associations with suspected communists at the time. Network TV, he ignited a huge controversy by singing Waist Deep in the Big Muddy during the Vietnam War. And I think for Dave Marsh, Pete Seeger was a mentor and a role model with whom he frequently disagreed, as he does with everyone.
And is there a Pete Seeger song that we could listen to and talk about?
Yeah, I think that Pete's song, Keep Your Eyes on the Prize, a movement song that he sang at the conference, in the concert album Dave was talking about with the SNCC Freedom Singers, was very much to the point. It was, you know, keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. The only thing we did wrong was stay in the wilderness too long. The only thing we did right was the day we began to fight. And that was it. It was a fighting song. It was a rallying cry. And Bernice Johnson Reagan of the SNCC Freedom Singers, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, has talked eloquently about how those songs provided the power for the marchers as they went out. They knew when they went on those marches that the police were also the Klan in many of those towns, and that they needed to find a way to overcome their individual fear, the fear that you could be attacked. And the only way you can do that is by standing together. And so Pete Seeger's Keep Your Eyes on the Prize.
Only thing that we did wrong was staying in the wilderness too long. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on. The only thing that we did right was the day we begun to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Oh, sing it again. Hold on.
Pete Seeger, Keep Your Eyes on the Prize. You can hear gospel elements in what he's singing. And I know Pete has talked about traveling and going into black churches and being amazed by the sounds he heard. Can you talk about that and also about what Dave Marsh would think about a song like Keep Your Eyes on the Prize?
Yes, the gospel element of American music generally, and African American music specifically, is absolutely central to the way Dave thinks. And he does that as somebody who is not religious at all. But there was, when Dave listened to gospel music, like Pete Seeger, went into black churches and experienced it live, he recognized that there was something there that, and transcended is not quite the right word, but was open to people who did not share the particular Christian vocabulary. And he understood that it was crucial to and deeply grounded in the fights for racial justice. When he's talking about Pete Seeger, Dave writes that what the music inspired was rebellion's necessary partner, conviction. Most importantly, the conviction that there really must be a better world somewhere, and that it was open to the likes of myself. Pete Seeger's version of a protest album offered a vision, and the core of that vision was not so much any particular songs, but the gentle persuasiveness with which he introduced them, the passion with which he laid out their origin or history or contemporary relevance, and the power with which he encouraged all presents to sing them. And that links Pete Seeger, who's not a gospel singer, with one of the singers who Dave has most aggressively championed, the great, great gospel singer Dorothy Love Coates from Birmingham, Alabama, who was actively involved with the movement in Birmingham, with Dr. King and the Children's Crusade, and that her music was a piece of that. And when he talks about the conviction, he describes her, Dorothy Love Coates, unknown to most even serious listeners of American music, as America's most powerful singer and songwriter, which is high, high praise. It reminds me of Bob Dylan saying that Smokey Robinson was America's greatest poet. And there's something there that's saying, look, let's listen beyond the marketing of these things. Let's listen into the depths of what's happening. And then he describes Dorothy Love Coates as a gospel warrior trying to win souls for Jesus and at the same time right some of history's wrongs.
We're going to meet Dorothy Love Coates and her music when we return in a moment with University of the Year. I connected to Dave because I knew he felt about music the way I felt about it. It was life-sustaining. It was central to your existence. That's what Bruce Springsteen said about Dave Marsh, music critic. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Craig Werner, and we're talking about Kick Out the Jams, Dave Marsh, the 60s, and the Sound of Freedom, looking at some of the writing for 35 years that Dave Marsh did about popular music. We were just talking, Craig, about Dorothy Love Coates. I am one of those people who had never heard of her, and it sounds like I should have. Tell us about her.
Yeah. Dorothy Love Coates is, I think the easiest way to understand her is she was a Mahalia Jackson who never went into the popular world. Mahalia always had a complicated relationship with her popular success, but she very much was Most white folks in the 1950s and 1960s would have known who Mahalia Jackson is. She was on CBS radio. She had a daily TV spot. Dorothy Love Coates, I think, was an equally great singer and a fantastic songwriter. With her group, the Original Gospel Harmonettes, she was grounded in Birmingham, Alabama, and she created a set of songs that when you listen to them today, you feel like they're songs that have always been there, that they feel like spirituals that go back to the 19th century, because she was deeply grounded in the vision of the Black church during the times of slavery. But she understood that the core of that was a drive for freedom, and that she committed herself deeply to freedom, and that was what Dave responded to, both the sound of her voice, which is fantastic, the quality of her songwriting, and the depth of her commitment. And part of his drive, and I share this with him, I wrote a section on Dorothy Love Coates in my book, A Change Is Going to Come, in conversation with Dave Marsh. I think she should be in the pantheon of the greatest singers in American history. Frank Sinatra, Elvis, you name it, she belongs there.
Well, let's hear something by her.
Yeah, this is one of her songs that was deeply embedded in the movement in Birmingham. It's a song called 99 and a Half Won't Do.
Dorothy Love Coates, 99 and a half won't do. Now, tell me how that's a gospel song, but then it also gets picked up later and becomes a secular song. But what makes that gospel? And as she's singing it, is she also wanting to call on people to give their all to the movement?
Yeah. And there's no division between what we would blithely called the personal and the political on that. And for the personal, for Dorothy Love Coates, meant your commitment to salvation. It's about the state of your soul, the state of your religious and spiritual being. And she's saying that you can't have it both ways. You've got to commit yourself 100% to God, she would say. And at the same time, because of where she lived and where she'd come up. She grew up in Alabama during the darkest days of Jim Crow and segregation. She understood that even when it wasn't obvious that the struggle was for African-American freedom and the freedom of all people, it was an encompassing vision. And so she would say that the same thing applied to a freedom fighter as applied to a good Christian, that you must commit yourself fully. 99 and a half just won't do. And Dave Marsh understood that profoundly, that he took that as a call to action, a call to call others to action. Gospel music is grounded in call and response, that the singer looks at the world around her and she sees injustice, she sees suffering, she sees that audacious hope. And she embeds that in her song. And Dorothy Love Coates' voice is incredible. I mean, it's worth listening to. Call her up on whatever platform you've got, on Spotify, whatever, and just listen to her. She sings out from the melody. The melody is there, but then you hear the textures in her voice, the depths of it. The highs are fantastic. And it just hits you in your heart and your stomach and your brain. And what she then is doing, and when she sings with the gospel harmonette, she has the other women with her, and so you hear their voices coming in. And Dorothy Love Coates is testifying to the world around her. And she's calling on her people. First of all, the women in her group. Secondly, the women and the people in the community around her to add their voices to it and to say, this is my commitment. Bernice Johnson Reagan talks about the core of African-American music, gospel particularly, being in the way that when you add your voice to that and say, I will be there, you will be there. Mm-hmm. And that is necessary because if you aren't all there, you're vulnerable.
And did she make a sort of conscious decision not to cross over and become a celebrity and then allow her songs to be performed by others?
She did. She had many, many overtures to become a rhythm and blues singer, they would have said at the time, soul singer a little bit later, and she would have blown it away if she had decided to do it. Aretha Franklin is the clear case on that, somebody who was deeply grounded in gospel, never lost the gospel part of her voice, but had huge popular success. Dorothy Love Coates said in so many words that going in that direction was entering the devil's world, and that once you were singing for the money, once you were singing for the fame, you were in trouble. And she had seen the singers on the gospel highway, as they called it, who had fallen victim to the lures of the flesh, you know, particularly the male singers, but not only. And she said, no, I'm staying here with my people. I'm living where I am. I'm being in my church. I'm committing myself to the struggle in Birmingham, Alabama. And so, yeah, she held firm.
And what would she have thought of the Wilson Pickett version of this song?
You know, I don't know. I should ask Dave Marsh about that. But her songs were picked up by soul singers, and they changed them a little bit. That happened with gospel music and soul music all the time. Curtis Mayfield, the great singer of the Impressions, talked about taking the songs he'd heard in his grandmother's church in West Chicago. He said, when I needed a song for the Impressions, I'd think about what I heard in church. And he remembered his grandmother singing, God gave me strength and don't make no sense not to keep on pushing. And Curtis changed it into, I've got my strength and don't make no sense keep on pushing. Because they wouldn't let him sing about God on the radio. Popular music wasn't doing that. So you would hear what happened with Dorothy Love Coates' music is people would pick it up, as in the song we'll listen to a little bit of now by Wilson Pickett called 99 and a Half Won't Do.
That's different in the Wilson Pickett one from the Dorothy Love Coates one.
What? Not a whole lot. No, the answer to that is that the production is for a popular audience. You hear the bass. There's a little less room for active call and response in it. Although when Wilson Pickett sang it live, it was. His biggest hit in the midnight hour was Straight Out of the Gospel Church. And when he would sing it in concert, you would see that there. So in reality, for those of us who fell under Dave Marsh's influence in the way we listened to the music, I'm not sure we hear much difference at all between the gospel and the soul. And Aretha Franklin, Dorothy Love Coates are soul sisters in those terms.
Now, there are other times where it's a Dorothy Love Coates song where when it gets redone as a secular song, they change from God to love. Can you talk about that song?
Sure. Ray Charles once said that that's all he did is just change, sing about a woman, singing about God. So just change the name. That's all there is to it. But with Dorothy Love Coates, sometimes you would hear a song like her song, You Can't Hurry Love. You Can't Hurry God. would be transformed by the Supremes into a song like You Can't Hurry Love. Here's one of Dorothy Love Coates' most famous songs in the gospel community, also one of Dave Marsh's very favorite songs of hers, called You Can't Hurry God.
You can't hurry God. Oh, no, you just have to wait. You have to trust him and give him time, children, no matter how long it takes. I know he's a God you can't hurry, but he'll be there. He'll be there, don't worry. You know he may not.
What happens when that gets worked on by the Supremes?
Yeah. You Can't Hurry God, again, is a song that has both its spiritual and its political dimension. One of the things that African-Americans needed to remember and feel during the movement was that this wasn't going to be quick. This was in it for the long haul. That's also what Pete Seeger was singing, Keep Your Eyes on the Prize, as you've got to hold on to it. And Dorothy Love Coates is saying, hold on to the vision, don't give it up. Well, when the Motown studio picked up on the gospel tradition, which it very much did, most of its singers had been raised in African-American churches. There's a deep connection between the black communities of Birmingham and the black communities of Detroit, people like Stevie Wonder and Martha Reeves. And even a group like the Supremes, which is usually thought of as a pop group, and they're bouncy and they make you smile and all that. And they picked up on You Can't Hurry God and transformed it quite a ways with the writing team of Holland Dozier and Holland at Motown. But they acknowledged the connection there. Dave Marsh heard the connection as he was growing up in Detroit right away. And they turned it into a pop hit. Interestingly enough, the first record ever bought was this record right here. This is Supremes doing You Can't Hurry Love.
I need love, love to ease my mind. I need to find someone to call mine.
Dorothy Love Coates, even though she didn't become a household name, her songs got out there.
Yeah.
And she also was part of this very important movement in the South. Can you talk about her civil rights activism?
Yes. She was in Birmingham, and Birmingham was ground zero for the movement at 1963, when Martin Luther King really became the Martin Luther King of myth and reality at the same time. Until the Birmingham movement, it was not clear what direction the civil rights movement was headed at that point in time. Birmingham turned things around, and music generally, and Dorothy Love Coates specifically, played a role in that. She sang for the people as they were gathering together. And the Birmingham movement overthrew legal segregation in the city by overfilling the jails. It was called the Children's Crusade, that young people, mostly high school students, but some as young as 8 years old, went out and Birmingham faced Bull Connor, probably the most vicious of the Southern sheriffs at the time. If you're looking for the villain from Central Casting, Bull Connor was it. And Martin Luther King knew that. He knew that if they went to Birmingham, that Bull Connor was going to provide photographs like the German Shepherd biting the demonstrator.
The hoses.
The hoses, the fire hoses, all of that. And Dorothy Love Coates was one of the people singing at the rallies as people came together, as they summoned the courage to march out. But music, and particularly music like that of Wilson Pickett and the Supremes, it's a little early for those two songs, but the same soul music, Ruby and the Romantics, Our Day Will Come, was one of the songs at that time. Again, that audacious hope. But the role that music played in Birmingham is important. People think of the movement songs, like Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around and those, but popular music was a piece of it. And specifically, the popular music playing on the radio. There was a DJ in Birmingham named Tall Paul. And the night before the rally that really set the movement into high gear in Birmingham, Tall Paul played the soul songs, and then he summoned the kids. He called the high school students, hey, there's going to be a big party down at Kelly Ingram Park tomorrow. And they knew what he was talking about. And Diane Nash and James Bevel, two of the unsung heroes of the movement, both people that Dave Marsh was intimately involved with. They had recruited the football players, the prom queens, to come out and summon the rest of the students together. And they had to overcome the fear of the parents on that. The parents were legitimately afraid of what would happen to their kids in Southern jails at the time. And so they've got Dorothy Love Coates' voice in their head saying, 99 and a half just won't do. And in the Baptist church at the time, there was no age limit on when you could commit yourself to Jesus. You didn't have to be 8 or 9 or whatever. Whenever you did it, you could do it. And Martin Luther King took that to heart, and he went into the church and told parents, hey, if your children are old enough to commit themselves to Jesus, they're old enough to commit themselves to the movement. And Dorothy Love Coates' music and her voice and her vision was very much a part of what took people out onto the streets in Birmingham.
I have to say that sort of discovering Dorothy Love Coates through this collection of writing by Dave Marsh and through your discussion, it feels like I've been given a gift. You know, I feel that way about discovering someone whose life or writing or, you know, the contributions they made has been suppressed, has been kept from us for some reason, or we just didn't know they're behind the scenes or they're neglected in some way. And so whenever you have a figure that comes to the foreground, you just feel like, oh, I should have been listening to that already.
Yes, and one of the important things about Dave Morris's work is he has championed musicians who are under-recognized, many of them. And he's acutely aware of the way that the music industry does that. He did call him in one of his magazines, Who Needs the Record Industry? And his answer to that is nobody. That the record industry is about enriching corporations, and that musicians, particularly musicians who are tied to a vision, are frequently lost. Patty Griffin, Gretchen Peters, Alejandro Escovedo, Charanga Cakewalk. Now, these are names you probably don't know.
Nope.
But you sure should. That Patty Griffin is one of the greatest songwriters of our time. And you can find her records. She's not unknown. She makes an okay living out of it, I think. But Dave Marsh will champion that again and again. And the most important thing about him as a music writer is he opens your ears to people you would not otherwise have heard, or certainly not otherwise have heard, the same way. His book on Elvis is fantastic. He wrote a book called Trapped, which takes the form of a letter to Michael Jackson, as Michael Jackson was at his peak. And Dave is really pleading with Michael Jackson not to go down the path that Michael Jackson went down. He's so smart about celebrity. He knows Springsteen well. They are friends. And I think Dave has been a important voice in Bruce Springsteen keeping his eyes on the prize, literally.
The title of the Simon & Schuster 2023 anthology of Dave Marsh's 35 years of music writing is Kick Out the Jams, and we're going to talk about why it's called that and hear some of Kick Out the Jams when we return on University of the Year. That's from MC5's Kick Out the Jams. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Craig Werner, and we are talking about a collection of music writing by Dave Marsh called Kick Out the Jams, Jibes, Barbs, Tributes, and Rallying Cries from 35 Years of Music Writing. Let's talk about that title, that song, that group, Kick Out the Jams.
Yeah, I love the title. The team that put together the anthology with Dave's permission, led by the great gospel music historian and cultural critic Daniel Wolfe, Danny Alexander, a Kansas City music activist, and Lauren Onkey, who was at one time senior music director for NPR and vice president of education at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, had a broad and deep appreciation of the fact that anybody knows Dave Marsh in the music writing world thinks that he's grouchy and opinionated and all of that. Well, he comes by it naturally. He's from Detroit, and I'll tell you that he's grounded in Detroit, and Detroit has a rich, rich, rich musical history involving jazz, involving gospel, involving, obviously, Motown music, but also a great rock and roll history. Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels, kind of the white version of Little Richard, came out of Detroit. Madonna comes out of Detroit. Eminem comes out of Detroit. Detroit's a black city with a whole lot of white folks who responded to it, including Dave Marsh. The MC5 are a group that, for those of us who grew up with rock and roll during the 60s, we know them. The band I played with opened our sets with Kick Out the Jams. We would start with that. But they have never really entered into the pantheon alongside The Who or The Rolling Stones or groups like that. Arguably, their best music belongs there.
And just to clarify, MC is for Motor City?
MC is the Motor City Five, yes. Absolutely. And the MC5, part of that is that they were politically radical. When you think about the most radical parts of the late 1960s, the MC5 were a soundtrack to that. They were pushing every boundary there was. Their manager, John Sinclair, was one of the founders and shapers, I think of him as the founder, of a group called the White Panthers. And the White Panthers thought of themselves as the white auxiliary of the Black Panthers. They were aware that the African-American freedom struggle was following its own logic at the time, but they thought that white people had a role to play in that by radicalizing white folks. And in Detroit, particularly, they understood that there were a lot of young white people whose ears and hearts and souls had been opened by black music, by Motown, by Wilson Pickett, but who didn't understand the drive for liberation behind it. Now, they had a particularly radical version of that. They had a version like that of the Weathermen, the more radical offshoot of the Students for Democratic Society in the late part of the 60s, and they pushed the boundaries every way that they could. The MC5 was centered on a commune, Translove Commune, or in the Wayne State area, around Wayne State University in Detroit, where Dave Marsh, who was at that time writing for Cream magazine before he moved to New York and connected with Rolling Stone, was a part of their sphere. Dave's politics were complex. I don't think he was ever radical in the sense that John Sinclair would have liked him to. At a celebration, online celebration we had for Dave Marsh's birthday a couple of years ago, John Sinclair spent most of his time grouching about the fact that Dave Marsh had become part of the corporate world, referring to his publishing books and things like that. That gives you a sense of where John Sinclair was. But the vision of liberation was one that took the African-American tradition and brought it into connection with the predominantly white counterculture of the time.
As we've moved from Pete Seeger to Dorothy Love with folk, yeah, to Dorothy Love Coates with gospel, yeah, now we're into rock.
And we're into the kind of rock and roll that had pushed past the harmonies and the psychedelic stuff that the Beatles and the Stones were doing at the time, the hard rock, and was deeply influenced by avant-garde jazz, by John Coltrane, by Pharoah Sanders. And the MC5, they can sound just chaotic at times if you're listening to them, but so could much of the jazz of that time. They were seeing that as blowing past the conventions of rhythm, of harmony, of song structure at the time, just as many people who lived on the communes, urban and rural at the time, were trying to imagine a radically new way to be in the world. And what was crucial about the MC5, and this made for an interesting conversation with Dave Marsh, is that the MC5 absolutely believed that working class white people and white intellectuals, the avant-garde, the people who were listening to John Cage, who were listening to avant-garde composers like Karlheinz Stockhausen at the time, who were frequently just dismissed as noise. They said, no, it's not noise. It's music. It's music from a world that we do not yet understand. But they were convinced that working class kids, whatever their race, could be a part of that too. It wasn't just for the intellectuals. They absolutely believed that intelligence wasn't tied to any kind of a degree. There's a great description in Dave's book about that. Talking about the MC5, he writes, they had every intention of changing the whole world every time out. And on their best nights, the band and those paying attention realized some incredible fragment of that ambition and were transported to a state where that alternate universe wasn't just a possibility, but the actual truth. Not only what was going to happen, but what was actually happening.
Let's listen to a little bit more.
Sure.
Of MC5.
Yeah. This song is called Come Together.
Come Together by MC5. Would you say that MC5, in addition to being a rock group, also is punk?
Yeah. That's not the Beatles' Come Together that you heard,
right,
which is also a great song, from almost exactly the same moment. But yes, the MC5 and the Stooges, another one of Dave Marsh's favorite groups, pointed the way to punk. And Dave actually was a person who coined the word. You find him in the Oxford English Dictionary.
Really?
As the first usage.
How did he come up with punk as a term?
Well, for him, punk was an attitude towards life. It was a refusal to play by the rules. It was a politicized punk for the MC5. But it was, Dave kind of revels in that attitude, that, and he listened to the music, you know. And it's interesting because my experience of Dave's taste is he's not particularly, punk isn't what I listen to when I'm with him. You know, we tend to listen to Dorothy Love Coates or music from the 60s or the whatever he's discovered last Tuesday. And he's always listening. But he saw punk as a refusal to play the game by the rules that the music industry was laying down. And particularly as the 60s turned into the 70s, one of the things that happened with music is it became commodified, it became niched. It was always a business. He always understood that. But the Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, and the resegregation of radio networks, radio formats in the 70s really bothered Dave. And he saw punk as a gesture of contempt for the trivialized version of rock that had come out of the 60s. It lost its hard edge. Dave loved 50s rock, too. Loved Gene Vincent, Chuck Berry, Little Richard. He absolutely loved. He loved that blow the top off it. All kick out the jams is a rephrasing from the MC5.
The collection is called Kick Out the Jams, Jibes, Barbs, Tributes, and Rallying Cries from 35 Years of Music Writing by Dave Marsh, opening our eyes to a lot of musicians and groups and movements. My guest has been Craig Werner. Thanks for opening my eyes to a lot more music.
Delighted as always.
And we're going to go out on Bruce Springsteen's Keep Your Eyes on the Prize. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year.
Streets up there paved with gold.